This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, and it's President's Day. Originally, the holiday served as a way to recognize the birthday of the first Commander-in-Chief George Washington. Over the years, it changed, just like the office of the president has evolved since Washington's time. Our next guest is here to give us the history of the office and how it's changed over nearly 230 years. Kenneth C. Davis is a historian and the author of several books, including In the Shadow of Liberty and Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
It is always a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the presidents, Ken, let's start with the day. I understand it's not actually technically called President's Day. Is that right?
That is correct. This is, and still will always be, as far as I know, George Washington's birthday. The confusion comes about because Washington's birthday was a federal holiday, a national holiday, celebrated on his actual birthday for many years, February 22nd. About 50 years ago, Congress introduced something called the Uniform Holidays Act, which created our beloved three-day weekends with Monday holidays. They moved Washington's birthday to the third Monday in February, which means it can never come on his actual birthday. But in many minds, that then sort of combined Lincoln's birthday on February 12th with Washington's birthday to become President's Day. That officially never happened. First of all, Lincoln never had a national holiday, which may surprise some people. It was a state holiday in many states, but not all states. And over the years, there's been a suggestion that this should be a day to honor all presidents, but officially it is still on the federal books as George Washington's birthday.
Interesting, but colloquially, it seems like we all say President's Day, except for you, Ken. We all say President's Day.
Except for me, and maybe at Mount Vernon, they uphold tradition. And of course, the big problem is whether to use an apostrophe and where to put it if you do use one. But no, I'm going to stick with Washington's birthday. And of course, it is a great opportunity to think about the presidency. There are so many aspects of it that we come to take for granted, although maybe less so now than previously, that we think it was always just like this. And of course, it hasn't been. And Washington, as the first president, really invented and set so many of the precedents for being president.
And Ken, let's start even a bit earlier than that. It wasn't inevitable that we were going to have a president with the powers that that job carried with it.
It wasn't inevitable at all. We have to go back to the fact that when the United States was created in 1776, and even before that, there was a Continental Congress, and then later a Congress of the United States, which had a president. And so there were presidents of the United States, but they were presidents of the Congress of the United States, different. In 1787, in the summer, as the gentlemen gather in Philadelphia to debate the future of the operating system of the government, what they come up with, of course, is the U.S. Constitution, working in secret, by the way. The question of the president really occupied a lot of their time. They knew they needed an executive. What they didn't want was a king, and what they didn't want necessarily was what Great Britain was evolving into, the parliamentary system where the head of a party became the leader of the state. So this was a big issue for them. What were the powers that they were going to give this man? They had just finished fighting a war against a king. They didn't want unlimited power in the hands of one man. It really scared them, especially if they were going to give them, as they did, to give the president the power to command the army. And that's why they kept the power to declare war in Congress's hands. Of course, that's been a somewhat meaningless distinction over these 200-odd years.
And there was a debate over how much power and how long the president would serve, as I understand it, and concerns that the president would just ultimately equal an elected king, right?
This was the great fear of the time. There's no question about it. And there was some debate about Should it be one term? Should it be 2 years at first? Should it be? There was even the suggestion that the executive be a three-person committee, which sounds like a real recipe for disaster, or a single six-year term. They came up with the system that existed for a very long time, which was that the president would serve for 4 years and then could run for re-election as many times as he liked. There was no limitation initially by the framers of the Constitution. Washington decided to step down after 8 years, and in that established a precedent and an informal one. A couple of other people tried to push up against that precedent a couple of times, but it was not, of course, until Franklin D. Roosevelt wins four consecutive terms that we amend the Constitution to limit it as it is today to a two-term presidency.
Talking to historian Kenneth C. Davis about President's Day, widely known as President's Day, the day we mark George Washington's birthday, looking back at the role of the president and how it's changed over the years. That's one way, Ken, that George Washington set the standard for how presidents would behave. What are a couple of other things that, it was a kind of a vague role, even with the constitutional definition. What else did he do to define that role?
Well, one of the things he did significantly was sort of issue what we would now today call executive orders. And one of the great powers that's, not clearly defined in the Constitution is what those executive powers actually mean. Now we have executive orders issued all the time on things that range from the trivial to the truly profound, of course. I am reminded of the fact that today is the anniversary of Franklin D. Roosevelt's executive order that that basically meant the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese in America, as well as some Italians and Germans in America in 1942, just after Pearl Harbor. So executive orders can be very, very profound things. We know that. So Washington began to commit some of those. The appointment of his cabinet, the reliance on the cabinet, all of these things were being invented as Washington went along, of course. He even writes in a letter at one point, "I am walking on untrodden ground." He had a great sense of the idea that what he was doing would establish precedent for a very, very long time. And he was very careful in many of his decisions. He was not a person who did things quickly, and he had some very good advice. You know, having a cabinet that was filled with Hamilton on one side and Jefferson on the other side, and having James Madison to whisper in your ear sometimes, and he was at living and presiding at a time when some of the giants of our history were still around.
As I understand it, he wasn't too keen on the idea of factions forming, and we didn't really have political parties then. I get the impression he wouldn't have been wild about that idea.
That's absolutely correct, and it's a very famous farewell address, which may have been written by Alexander Hamilton. That's the general presumption that Washington warns against the powers of what he called faction parties. Of course, the Constitution nowhere defines the role of political parties in our system. It evolved naturally and somewhat quickly, even though men like Washington and Jefferson and Madison talked about the danger of faction. They were kind of thinking about parties that would exist along kind of regional lines and geographic lines, or maybe some that would be on economic lines. They didn't quite see the quick evolution of a two-party system as it came to be in this country. Very soon after Washington was elected, you did have the Congress dividing up into first the Federalists, who sort of went along with Hamilton's ideas, and the so-called Anti-Federalists, or later Democratic Republicans, which is kind of confusing to us today, who followed Jefferson's ideas. And all the things that we think about today, big state versus small state, central power versus states powers, the power of the federal government to run the economy, those were debates they were having 218 years ago as the nation was just getting underway, and they continue to this day.
Kenneth C. Davis is with us, historian, author of several books, including the Don't Know Much About History series. He's with us to talk about the history of the presidency on this, the observance of George Washington's birthday, also known as President's Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of the presidency? What significance does the office hold for you? Growing up, did you ever want to be president of these United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the history of the presidency on this President's Day with historian and author Kenneth C. Davis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the office of the president and its history? What do you think has changed with the presidency over the years? Did you grow up or does your kid want to be a president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ken, let's spend a minute on Abraham Lincoln, who unofficially shares the title of President's Day with George Washington. Very different background. George Washington, of course, had this military leadership background. Abraham Lincoln served briefly in the Black Hawk War here in Wisconsin, and he, in a speech, I think, said he gave blood only to mosquitoes along the way. He never saw action. That was his military experience. Talk about his lead up to becoming president.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, last Monday, February 12th, was Lincoln's birthday, and it has never been celebrated as a national holiday. That's part of where, as I mentioned, the confusion comes from about calling this President's Day. Lincoln's birthday was never a national holiday because there were a couple of states that wouldn't probably have wanted to honor Abraham Lincoln. You can probably figure out which those states might be, but that's the truth. Of course, Lincoln is, and I think widely acknowledged still, to be the greatest president. In fact, the New York Times has a listing of historians' rankings of presidents today on their op-ed page. Lincoln, Washington, and both Roosevelt's FDR and TR are the top four. I have the same top four in my own rankings and don't know much about the American president, but Lincoln was, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest because of the terms under which he came to office, and the crisis he faced was the greatest crisis in American history, and the way in which he led the country for those years of war and then what happened afterwards put him at the pinnacle as far as I'm concerned. But you're right, Washington, born of slaveholding, and if not aristocracy, certainly the well-to-do Virginia planter, and he certainly became wealthier as time went by. Lincoln, born in true abject poverty, orphaned, I shouldn't say orphaned, but lost his mother at a very, very young age. His stepmother became very influential to him. Had this very, very cursory education. In that, he's very much like George Washington. Neither Lincoln nor George Washington had much in the way of formal education, but both were extremely brilliant in their own ways. Lincoln had also, as a writer, I say this with great admiration, he was the most poetic of our presidents, and one need only look at his first inaugural, for instance, to get a sense of that majestic poetry where he talks about the better angels of our nature, which we sorely need these days.
You mentioned the top four best presidents in American history. Looking back historically at presidents, is there a consensus about a couple of the worst presidents in U.S. history?
Absolutely. That same survey that I mentioned today in the New York Times actually puts William Henry Harrison as the lowest of the ranked presidents. But that's kind of unfair because he was only in office for a month. He was, of course, the president who died a month after taking his inaugural oath of office and caught pneumonia and died. We think it was pneumonia. a little discrepancy about that. I should say that the current office holder is actually ranked beneath him in that ranking in the New York Times by historians. But I always have held that a president shouldn't be judged until he's finished his term in office or removed from office. And so that's why I would withhold such judgment. But James Buchanan has always been considered among the worst, along with Andrew Johnson. And they're interesting because they were the president both immediately before and immediately after Abraham Lincoln. The country was very ill-served by the two men who bookend Lincoln's extraordinary presidency. Buchanan did very little and may have even worsened the race towards the Civil War, and Andrew Johnson proved to be a man utterly incapable of bringing the nation together during this dreadful period after the war was over and so much of the country was in tatters and in cinders and there was so much death and destruction. And he was a man utterly lacking the character to attempt to bring the country together.
Talking about the history of presidents of the United States, Ken Davis is with us, author of the Don't Know Much About History series. Ken, I've never wanted to be president. Seems like a really tough job, a thankless job while you're serving. The job I would love is ex-president. Can you talk about some notable post-presidential careers?
Well, there are quite a few that are happy, and many will say that the happiest day, and I believe it was Harry Truman who said it was the happiest day was leaving office, but one thinks of William Howard Taft, for instance, who went on to become the first president, and to date only president, who was appointed to the Supreme Court, which may have been his ambition all along. He was a jurist and a serious legal scholar, so he ends up on the Supreme Court. John Quincy Adams has a very, very notable career after his single term in office, going back to the House of Representatives, the only president who returned to the House of Representatives after. And the highlight of that career was his fight to end what was called the gag rule, which was a rule in Congress that didn't allow any petitions or any mention or even reference to slavery to come before Congress. Again, the importance of slavery in American history and presidential history cannot be understated.
I want to look a little bit about what qualifications were for a president and how that's changed over time. George Washington was kind of a gimme, it seems like. He was a big name there. But it seems like for a long time, politics was at such a state level, it was hard for someone to get that national reputation. So who did they turn to then?
Well, it should be noted that when those gentlemen are debating the Constitution in 1787, Washington was presiding over the convention and sitting in the front very silently. He didn't think it's his job as president of the convention to weigh in on this debate, although he did so privately. But everyone in the room knew what was clear, that when they were talking about the president, perhaps awkwardly, they were talking about George Washington. They knew he would be first. Benjamin Franklin says as much. He said, "We know who'll be the first man at the helm, and he'll be a good one. After that, we're on our way to an elected monarchy." So there was a tremendous fear. Of course, in the early years, being vice president was the most direct route to becoming president, or perhaps Secretary of State. Adams was Washington's vice president, and Jefferson was Adams's vice president, although that was not a matter of a great happiness. They were not of the same party, and even though they were allies from 1776, their politics had gone in very different directions. So there was still something to be said about national standing at that time. And of course, in the early years, we have to also point to military experience and even military success being far, far more important than it certainly has been in recent years. One, of course, thinks obviously of Washington, Andrew Jackson in later years, more recently, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Polk, even though he hadn't really served much in the Army, was mentioned as a little Andrew Jackson because of his service. Generals Tyler and Taylor were war heroes. So that was a significant aspect of presidential electability in the early part of our history. Gradually it changed.
I want to bring on a caller. Bob is with us in Antioch. Bob, hi.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bob?
Hey, I had a general kind of question. How have the powers of the president have changed? We're talking about historical presidents in the past. They had a group of powers. Are today's or contemporary presidents, do they have more powers, less powers?
Gotcha, Bob. Thanks for the call, Ken. We could spend a long time on that. We just have a minute and a half or so. Some key changes in presidential power.
I'll try and cover it quickly. That's 200 years of history. I mean, clearly, you look at the Constitution, there are very circumscribed powers, and there's been a pendulum swing over those 200-plus years towards the president and away from Congress. Those men were very concerned about the balance of power. A lot of people would say that Congress has too willingly and too freely surrendered many of its powers, especially the war-making power, to the president. We've been at war for a long time now in this country without a declaration of war, which is Congress's responsibility. So that's clearly one. The president offers up a budget. Congress has the constitutional authority to decide how the money is to be spent, but we do allow the president to make a budget now. It's not always the one that gets passed.
Ken, briefly, as we wrap up, some quick thoughts for us on President's Day or George Washington's birthday observed.
Well, I like to have fun with history. I think being very serious for a moment, though, we are at a real crisis point in the presidency and in our democracy in many respects. And I say that not lightly at all. So I, as a citizen and a historian, am very concerned about where we stand right now in terms of presidential power and the failure of Congress to fulfill its role as an immediate check on the power of the presidency. I think we really need to revisit that.
We'll leave it there for now. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. And anyone can find out more at don'tknowmuch.com.
It's Kenneth C. Davis, historian, author of several books, including the Don't Know Much About History series and In the Shadow of Liberty. He joined us to talk about the history of the presidency of the United States.